Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I am Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. When I tell people what I do for a living, I often hear surprise in their voices that so many children need our help. There's a sentiment that mental health problems in children are rare and perhaps something that happens to others. It can't possibly hit close to home. We know that isn't true. One out of every four children in the United States qualifies for mental health treatment, but tragically, only 25% of those children actually get help. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services found that in the last 10 years, rates of major depression among teens have more than doubled. Hopelessness and suicidal thoughts have increased by 71%. Suicide rates among children have mirrored these changes, increasing by 56%. It is, as one researcher wrote, an epidemic of anguish. With the background of this epidemic of anguish, we have for the last year had the overlay of social isolation and anxiety created by a global pandemic. Children have lost loved ones and are away from the normative social, educational, and developmental experiences of school and sports and play. In today's podcast, we're going to speak with Mickey Prince, a clinical social worker at the Guidance Center who treats some of our most psychiatrically troubled children. We will hear their reflections on what they see in their clients, the struggles the children already faced, and the impact the pandemic is having upon them. Welcome, Mickey. Thank you for joining us today. I'm really happy to have you here. Our audience doesn't know much about you the way I do, so if you'd like to please share a little bit about yourself before we begin.
Absolutely. My name is Mickey. I am an MSW, that's a master's in social work. I went to grad school at Cal State Long Beach, and I am a clinical therapist for the Guidance Center at the Compton location. And I've been with the Guidance Center for over a year and a half, and I love it. It's exactly where I want to be. I'm growing as not only as a clinician, but as a human being. I come from, both of my parents were activists and community organizers, and so social work is something that is in my blood. And I found working with children and families sort of checks that box for me, how I can contribute and what can I bring to the table of trying to make things a little bit better for human beings. So thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. You know, my first question for you is, as a clinician, what would you say to someone who is surprised by the scope of mental health problems we see amongst our youth?
I'm not surprised. That would be my first response. I think in my experience, it's easier for adults to wrap their heads around adult mental health. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. One, typically, not all the time, adults have the language to tell you what's going on, right? I'm not feeling good. I'm feeling sad or whatever they're feeling. And with children, as we know, they're a little bit more complex in terms of how they communicate their stress, right? How they communicate their internal pain, their trauma, not feeling good inside is through their behaviors and actions. And those behaviors and actions to adults are not easy. And so adults kind of tend to focus on those behaviors. And so this is when we hear adults and teachers and parents like, you know, little Billy is acting out, or he's being manipulative, or he's fighting, right? But what does acting out mean, right? Acting out means simply, it's a language thing, right? Kids don't have the language to describe what's going on inside. So they're acting it out. But that's something that adults tend to focus on. They look at the behavior. But when you have a conversation with this adult who's surprised, looking at underneath, looking at the behaviors underneath can be like, oh yeah, okay, it could be a mental health thing. It's just sort of a new way of looking at children's behaviors and how they respond to their stress, right? They just don't have the language for it. So it can just be a little bit surprising when we know that there's stuff underneath going all of that, you know, behind that acting out.
So people don't conceptualize it as a mental health issue. They conceptualize it as simply bad behavior or a child being a brat or a failure of adult discipline, rather than the underlying mental health issue that we know it is.
Exactly. And so how the behavior wants to be addressed, right? Fix this behavior, but the mental health isn't being recognized or identified, right? It's just from this behavioral lens. And we know that there's different. Children are just communicating their distress and their trauma through their behaviors.
Could you describe for us what kinds of presentations do you see predominantly amongst your clients? What's their diagnostic presentation? What are their struggles? Like, try to give us a picture, if you would, of your clients, your caseload.
Sure. And I want to tackle this question using this trauma-informed lens a little bit, I think, like what most of us do. So when we're talking about diagnosing, the symptoms that I see in response to a traumatic event, right, how their brain is organized in response to the trauma, it looks like anxiety, right? So we're looking at anxiety, depression, ADHD, oppositional defiant. You know, and these are children who aren't concentrating in school, who are irritated, they're on edge, and they're defiant, sleep disturbance. And so that's a presentation of what's going on, right? And then it checks the box for some of these diagnostic presentations, right? But trauma is something that happens inside the body. A traumatic event is something that happens. So it's the body and the way the brain is organized from the trauma, you see these diagnostic presentations, again, typically defined as depression, ADHD, and things like that.
So when you talk about trauma, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I'm learning, I'm a newer clinician, but I think how I define it for myself is, so again, there's the traumatic event, right? That could be housing insecurity, food insecurity, domestic violence, this pandemic, right? That's the event, sexual abuse, neglect, right? That's the traumatic event. But when we're talking about trauma, at least in my experience and what I'm learning through the kiddos that I support, it's what's happening inside of them. It's what happens to their body, what happens to their brain, right? What happens if you're looking at it from a neurological lens, which I'm learning how to do, it's what's going on with their brain. And so that's how I think when I think of trauma, the difference between trauma and a traumatic event.
To make sure I understand, the traumatic event is the thing that happens, and that can be defined pretty broadly. But then the trauma is the after effect, the long-term impact on the child of whatever the event was.
Yeah, totally. And there's different like degrees, right? There's different levels. There's different variations of the traumatic event. It doesn't have to be as extreme as sexual abuse. It could be divorce, right? It could be, there's different levels.
You know, the families, the children of the Guidance Center, they all struggle with poverty, with community strife, community violence. Are these kinds of mental health issues limited to lower income families and neighborhoods?
So absolutely not. Mental health does not discriminate, right? It doesn't just impact kiddos with what you described, poverty, housing, and food insecurities. Anyone can experience a traumatic event that impacts their mental health in a negative way. And any kid can experience disruption in their attachment. And also, for me, when I think about trauma, I think about, okay, this event happened. What did that do with the attachment that that child needs to thrive and survive, right? And usually there's a disruption in that. So any child can experience a disruption in their attachment. And again, that impacts the way a child's brain is organized and where they're at developmentally. So yeah, it does not discriminate.
So while we know then that mental health doesn't discriminate, does poverty impact the mental health of our children?
Absolutely. Children living in poverty are experiencing distress, and they're experiencing their parents' distress. And as we know how mirrored neurons work in the brain, when a child sees their parents stressed out, they're experiencing the same stress, right? And so these kids are coming to school tired because they probably didn't get much sleep. They're irritable. Their stress response system is so activated due to their high levels of distress. So they're not learning. And depending how long a child is living in poverty, this can really impact the way the child's brain is organized. And their behaviors are going to mimic sort of this flight, fight, freeze response. So if you have a kid who's in fight mode, they're going to be really irritable. They might run out of the class or not even go to school, right? These kids are not going to school and have high absenteeism because they're just so triggered. And also parents who are dealing with poverty are on survival mode and may struggle with meeting the attachment need and emotional need that their kiddo needs to thrive. And not because they don't want to, it's just because they're overwhelmed with their environmental circumstance.
What about racism or bigotry? I know that that can so often go hand in hand as well with poverty. Many of the communities that we serve are predominantly Black and Brown communities. So how does systemic racism or bigotry impact children's mental health?
Yeah, this is such a great big question. And I'm thinking about a couple of clients in mind and using my experience, right, with this population that I'm serving. The first thing that comes to mind is the types of kids that receive types of diagnoses, right? So for example, I see African-American kids and other kids of color diagnosed with ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder as opposed to, you know, white kiddos. And another thing that I've been seeing, and that also I think falls under this implicit biasism, bigotry, and systematic racism as well. And when I think of systematic racism and I think of DCFS, I think the types of reports being made, for example, from teachers, tend to report on African-American families more so than I see with white kiddos. And this is just my experience working within this population.
And just for the audience, just to clarify, DCFS is Department of Children and Family Services, and that's sort of the protective services arm of our government. And I think, Mickey, what you're referencing is that statistically, families of color are certainly reported on more frequently for similar instances, similar occurrences, and I think cases are open statistically more against families of color than of Caucasian families.
Exactly. And also, in terms of, I want to go back to this implicit biasism, I think educators, you know, we all view the world from a very specific lens, right? We learn our values and our morals from our family. And sometimes, you know, I've come across educators because of their experience, they're viewing children from a very specific lens, right? They're from just based on how they grew up and what their values are. And they have very specific beliefs regarding certain types of children. And that will convey into how they interact with the Black and brown kiddos that we serve.
Well, and I wonder too, you know, we all have our own lens as we view the world, but, you know, all the struggles going on right now with regard to Black Lives Matters, et cetera, what it might feel like as a young African-American boy, for example, to be growing up in this world right now in terms of your self-esteem and your notions about your own self-worth.
Absolutely. In fact, I had a conversation with an 8-year-old kiddo who I've been working with for a year, and he was so insightful on BLM and how he, or Black Lives Matter movement. And we were talking about Dr. Martin Luther King, and I felt like his attitude and his confidence was better, and as opposed to a few months ago, right, when all of this stuff was going down, and it impacted him. You know, children internalize their world when they see a reflection of themselves not accurately portrayed. That's going to impact their self-esteem and their confidence. And talking with this 8-year-old kiddo yesterday was so moving, and he was reminded me how insightful these kiddos are when it comes to these bigger conversations.
Let's talk a little bit about COVID now, because that's turned everything upside down. So you already worked with very at-risk children and families. How have you managed to engage them during a pandemic? I can't imagine that clinical work with children is easily managed remotely.
Yeah, it's not. it's a different dynamic. And I'm a type of clinical social worker where I like face-to-face and I do a lot of play therapy. So this was quite an adjustment. But the biggest way that I have maintained engagement that is working, because they keep calling me back and making our appointments, is I'm consistent. I'm very flexible, and I'm lucky to be flexible. And some of us don't work that way, but I am. I'm very flexible, and lots and lots and lots of engagement with parents, checking in with parents. I'm a parent, and I would love someone to say, Mickey, how are you doing, right? And I felt this way before COVID, that I think parents are the gatekeepers to their children, and you have to have a relationship with the parent or the caregiver or whoever is supporting that child to really maintain a relationship. Because if there's no relationship with the parent, I'm not going to be successful in supporting their children. And so that's the parents. For the kids, I really learned to meet them where they're at through this lens. That means, you know, I'm creative in the way that I interact with these kiddos. And I find myself engaging in a lot of regulating activities because they're so stressed out. So what does that look like? That looks like maybe playing video games with them or watching anime together. It's really regulating for kids to engage in that. And so, or watching cartoons. I've started a little band with one of my kiddos. We just play music together, and that's something, meeting him where he's at and interacting with him in a creative way.
And that's able to work all right over Zoom or over a remote format?
Yeah. And again, I have to have this relationship with parents because parents are so frustrated with technology. So it's, but now they're over the learning curve. I'm so proud of the parents that I'm working with because we can get through it. They're on Zoom. They're they're figuring it out. So that was a working relationship that I spent a lot of time in, just making sure that they understand the technology. And sometimes technology doesn't work, and that's super frustrating.
Was that an unexpected struggle, the technological lessons, or like what struggles have you encountered?
technology is one. It's really, in general, it's frustrating for any of us when technology doesn't work, but this is a whole new ball game. So I've become a little bit of an IT person. But I would say what the first sort of struggle that came to mind was the attention span of the little ones. I have little guys. And so at first it was like not connecting over Zoom was just not happening. It was a few minutes and then they were sort of checked out, especially because these little ones are used to doing play therapy with me and I'm very involved in the play therapy. And so this was just different. And so the attention span and also Zoom fatigue, not only for the kiddos because they're in school all day and then they're on Zoom with me, but for myself. Getting used to Zoom and being on Zoom all day is really exhausting. So I didn't really expect that. And just sort of learning how to cope with that. And then the other thing that comes to mind that I didn't think about it was that a lot of my clients were regressing in their behaviors and having a really difficult time with their emotional regulation. And that makes sense to me. They're experiencing this trauma of the pandemic. And so they're just feeling really disconnected from their bodies and their emotions. And parents too, like parents that I have wonderful relationships, they're really irritable and short with me. So just sort of re-engaging was something like, okay, this is a little bit of a struggle. This is not what I was expecting.
So the primary impact then you see of COVID on your children is that this anxiety and sort of the disassociation in some ways?
Absolutely. Kids are playing more video games. They're doing things, you know, what we call they're dissociating, right? So that's they're checked out on their video games. They're on their phones and parents are super frustrated. But parents, we're doing it too. We're dissociating. We're on our phones more. We're on our computers because it's like this protective measure. It's so much going on and we need to dissociate, right? That's just what we're doing. And our kids are doing that too. So I'm noticing that. Yeah, exactly.
Have you seen any unexpected blessings from the safer at home or from the pandemic?
Absolutely. Like on a personal note, spending time with my wife and my son 24/7, which is stressful, but kind of cool because I'm watching him grow. He had a birthday this year and he turned 6. And so just watching him kind of develop into his own little person is really, really cool. Also, I'm so surprised by the resiliency of my clients and the kiddos. And they're so smart and insightful and wonderful. And it's a learning curve for them how to interact with me. I have clients who I've worked with more remotely than I have in person. And we have really deep connections. And that's been super cool. That's been a really unexpected blessing for me.
That you were able to establish that despite everything. You know, I think a lot, we're also eager to when it's going to be safe and we can go back to normal and return to school and return to work and see people in person again. But I worry quite a lot that it's not going to be that smooth of a transition. We've been sheltered now for so long. Do you have any tips about how we could maybe help our children return to a post-COVID world?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not going to be easy. It's another adjustment, right? And the kiddos that we service and that I see typically have a hard time with adjustment and change, right? So for me, the first thing that comes to mind with anyone who is working with a child, a parent, a teacher, a principal, social worker, anyone, is to be really patient and allow time for children to adjust and reacclimate themselves. Don't take it personal and have realistic expectations, especially when it comes to academics. And I was saying this when COVID first started, right? You know, I would have parents call me, Mickey, the teacher is calling me every single day because my kid is absent from school. Like, that's so stressful. And the teachers are under stress as well, right? But just having realistic expectations for children is going to be really helpful. And also what I was saying before when COVID first started happening is really spending time with your kid, just spending time with them, and also setting a predictable schedule is going to be really important. It helps kids feel contained and a little bit more in control when there's predictability in their life. But really just having patience and expecting some of these regressions and behaviors, because that's how kids communicate their pain.
I think we're going to have to place some effort on normalizing that experience, because I think there's such the feeling, oh, it's going to be such a relief. It's going to be so great. There's such longing to get back to our normal lives. And I think it's going to be a big transition, and we should all expect that it's going to be bumpy from time to time. All right, last question. This is very tough work that you do. What gives you hope to keep moving forward? Do you see a light in the darkness?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there has to be a light at the end of this tunnel, and there already is. And I think part of my job is to rekindle hope. If I look at the recovery model, one of the first steps is hope, right? Instilling hope in our clients. And this was even something prior to COVID. This is something that was very meaningful for me, is to instill and rekindle and remind our kiddos and families of hope. And so absolutely, I think that there is going to be light, and there already is. Another thing that gives me hope, and I mentioned it earlier, is their families and the kids' resilience to all of this, and seeing them grow and thrive in their own way and being flexible is really cool to watch, and humbling to see them grow in this way. So and I think helping, and I have to believe it, and I do. Kids can read us, right? They're very good at reading us, and really what is our authenticity? And I have to believe that there is hope, and there is. We'll get through this. It won't be easy. We need lots of patience, but things will get better.
You know, I always say, when people say how difficult our job must be, that I think we are in the remarkable position of getting to watch children learn to feel better and learn to like and trust themselves, and to evolve, to be able to be a part of that process with a small child, I just think is the most amazing honor. So yes, to me, it's the kids that they're the light in the darkness, in my opinion. Thank you, Mickey, for sharing your insights and experiences as a frontline mental health worker. And thank you as well for doing the very important work that you do.
Thanks for having me.
What we've highlighted today is the reality of mental health struggles among young children and teens in our communities. My hope is that we've all gained some insight, even as simply a greater acceptance that mental health struggles among children are real and pervasive, and that there is still always hope. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will make it easier for a struggling child to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other. Please join us next time for episode 2, when we talk to Dr. Tiffany Brown, Assistant Superintendent of Long Beach Unified School District. We will learn how schools are trying to manage the educational, emotional, and social needs of children during a global pandemic, and what her concerns are for an eventual return to the classroom.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Production assistance provided by Julie Ruano. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation, or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.